Accession number 19906, Reel 4.
What the band child reel for?
Sea mocks. I should explain on Admiralty charts.
What the band child reel for?
Sea mocks. I should explain on Admiralty charts. They are shown as landmarks that you can observe from the sea, and they have certain heights above water level, etc., etc. They give you a fair idea for navigation purposes. For our purposes, they were landing marks. They would eventually be used to place it between the beaches. The landing beaches would be sighted. My eventual destination was to be Gold Beach. We were to land, I believe, on the 5th of June. Weather conditions were rather bad. The whole operation, as everyone knows by now, was delayed for about 24 hours. But we were at sea for quite a lot of the time. Eventually, we went in. I was there in fairly early hours of the morning, in position off what became Jig Sector of Gold Beach. That is to say, the westward end of what became Arromulch, the Mulberry Harbour. We didn't know all of this. You only knew as much as you needed to know for your particular parts of the operation. We were equipped to fight, but our primary objective was disabling the German beach defences as far as possible underwater, which would affect the landing craft coming in. Mines, the Germans had a considerable amount of mines laid, which would be dealt with by first deep water and then inshore minesweepers. We would get out as far as we could and work in from where their sweeping line would be, which wouldn't affect the landing craft. They would pass over them probably, but we definitely had to clear those in the water marks, that is to say between the high and low tide levels. Because if you didn't do that, not only would the landing craft become disabled, but the troops themselves, obviously. We had weapons with us which would enable us to give covering fire once the first assault wave was coming in, to assist them, because they too would be putting fire ashore, as well as the heavier vessels out to sea and the more immediate bombardment vessels. We had orders to blow the German charges, which were on and between the beach defences, the ones that would be underwater. For that purpose, we worked in pairs. My own particular one was a marine diver. I knew him as Bob, because they didn't encourage, although you worked together, you were assigned together on particular nights. This way, you could never really divulge a lot of information if captured. Security being paramount in these matters. It was essential that the enemy didn't understand how you worked. A lot of confusing and fictitious unit numbers were given out on raids. The Germans must at times, if they captured anybody, think there were about 200 to 300 types of units in use. Far from the truth. Nevertheless, it all seemed to work. It's all part of the game of bluff and counter-bluff, which I've learned in the years after this. On the morning of D-Day itself, we finally went in. I was ashore before 4 o'clock in the morning, and I immediately started work on my designating. I think the tide was making fairly well. There was a diver working below me, and he had breathing. He could breathe. I had what's now known as snorkel gear if I needed it, but I worked virtually on the surface and working There's a long pier at Arromanches. I was working to the seaward side of that, and our craft was tied up under it. And I went about my business. I had roughly about 3 minutes between the known types of charge. You had to be able to blow those charges, but not before the bombardment started. Some of the bombardment, we think, was designed to land on the beach defences themselves and on the sand. Obviously, some would fall in the water. That was a chance that had to be taken. The bombardment duly opened, and we duly started blowing charges. The Germans would mistake them, we hoped, for the bombarding ammunition coming in, not their own charges. So that, when a landing craft came in, they may well strike the obstacles, but they didn't get blown up. We didn't succeed in doing all of it, and I understand since that a good number of our personnel were killed. They did indeed open fire as soon as the landing craft appeared, and I engaged what looked like a beach kiosk, but I'd seen what I took to be either an Oerlikon or a heavy German heavy machine gun muzzle emerging from the slot. I had it covered and I fired straight into it. I had a personal weapon which I was using, which was an American Remington carbine, an excellent short-range rapid-fire weapon. Three modes of firing, single shot, semi or full automatic, providing you've got a magazine on. This stood me in good stead. I managed to subdue whatever was going on there, by which time the infantry landing craft were in and there was considerable fighting taking place. Casualties were going down. They were still in engagement when about later in the morning, we'd heard an enormous amount of firing coming from our right, to use the civilian term, to our starboard along the beach. And it was, of course, Omaha. Now, we knew who was going in on Omaha, and most of the conveyance of the troops ashore was being carried out by the Royal Navy. This is not generally known, but British naval personnel were on Omaha Beach before the Americans. They were there for the same reason that we were, and they were still on that beach along with the United States combat engineers trying to disarm explosives and mines when the first wave of landing craft came in and came under very heavy fire from the German defences, which were very well sighted. We were ordered up to give support. Now, we naturally thought that we were going up there to do what we'd been doing. You might get involved in fighting, but the first primary objective was to disarm whatever mines and explosives you could lay hands on, to give them broaden the landing craft front so you get more landing craft in. Unfortunately, when we got there, there was an enormous firefight taking place, and we had no alternative but to join in. We got into the water. Practically the first thing I became aware of was a lot of objects in the water, the peculiar colour of the water, the froth. I think everybody that was ever on that beach knows this. The noise, the confusion, the stunk, as I've said, were overpowering. You had heavy bombardment taking place from the sea. You had the cries and the screams, a lot of awful young men, bodies nudging you in the water. I became by turns first very afraid. Then as you do, you settle down, I became colder and more angry. The Germans were standing up, shooting at them. They were throwing grenades down on them. I thought, this isn't right. It was a landing craft which was abandoned. I crouched alongside the landing craft and I opened fire, along with other people. I was aware that there were comrades of mine also in action and exchanging fire. I don't know how long this went on. I have no idea. I remember a lad clutching hold of my ankle. He was an American, badly bleeding. I had a knife on. I cut his equipment off him. And the first landing craft that came in on the other side of me was fortunately a Red Cross, one of ours bearing ambulance marks. Not that the Germans cared about that, they fired at that as well. After all, they were defending their beachhead. Managed to get a few lads into there. The surprising thing that happened was, I don't know how long I'd been at it, I'd been re-ammunitioned by Americans coming in, seeing the weapon I was using. They dropped me off spare clips, a whole box of Remington ammunition. Now and again there'd be a little lull and I'd spot something that was uncovered that looked suspiciously like a mine, and I would deal with it if I could. I thought, I don't want some poor sod to tread on that. There was enough going on as it was. I noticed the flashes, of course, some of them were second rangers, which upset me even more because I had trained with some of them. And something comes over you. It's almost, your actions are almost automatic. I was clipped more than once by bullets or ammunition. It didn't seem to matter. Nothing really hit me, as I could tell. It was pinging and clanging off you like rain, tracer flying in all directions. Grenades, none of them came near me, fortunately. But an awful lot of people were getting killed on that beach. The RN, that's the Royal Navy, they decided not to put them in the water where they were told to, but were driving the landing craft right up the beach and turning them round to give them some cover to get off. This was against the express orders of the American Admiral, who was in charge at the end of the operations, I understand since. As I say, this seemed to go on for an interminable time. Eventually, the Rangers did it. Somehow they got off that beach. The other troops were still pinned down, but they did. The second Rangers went up that damn cliff. It took an awful lot of casualties trying to do it. But once again, I became aware later in the day of much more noise, if that were possible. They were using LCRs, that's rocket-equipped landing craft, which fired more than 2,000 rockets a time. And they were literally shifting the rear positions of the cliff away, where a lot of the artillery fire and whatnot was coming from over the back, I understand. The Rangers had gone up. They'd done their stuff. I found a bit of space and I was able to get on with some mine clearance. And one or two more of our people appeared. But I think we took quite a few casualties along that beach. I was withdrawn from there and repaired to one of our depot craft to sort of get cleaned up, get some food, get a bit of sleep, and go back in again onto my own beach, Gold Beach, which by this time was secure. Omaha, there was still fighting going on for it, but they had more or less got a good foothold. But that was a terrible, terrible experience. Bearing in mind, I had no idea I was going to be an infantryman when I joined the Navy, because that's basically what you became for that time. I only thank my lucky stars that I knew how and when to use weapons. During the course of that particular day, peculiar day, somebody tapped me on the shoulder. And when I turned round, it was a German. And my Remington carbine was up his nose in an instant, but he was only trying to surrender. He too was paralysed with fright. He'd been wounded. It turned out he was a German military policeman. a much older man than us, obviously conscripted into the army. Before I managed to, I covered him so he wouldn't get hit again, got him into one of the Red Cross landing craft, and it was a Royal Navy one, and our lads took care of him. And before he left, he got something out of his tunic pocket and pressed it in my hand. It looked like an Iron Cross. It turned out to be a German police long service medal, which I still have to this day. That's how action is. It's so much confusion. Surprising things happen. You look along the beach and suddenly you see a whole warship, a minesweeper. She struck a mine. She seems to go up in the air and disintegrate completely. People scream, they shout, they call out for mothers and Lord knows what. They all seem younger than you. I was 18 at this time. I was very close to my 19th birthday, which would take place on the 13th of June. I had a wry thought about that. I thought to myself, I shan't see my 19th birthday. But as it transpired, I did. I went backwards and forwards on various missions, reporting to the Beachmasters, working on explosives. Sometimes you might get caught up in a little bit of action again, but not much. And then on the night of the 9th of June, I was taking passage in a motor torpedo boat. I'd been all the way back to New Haven to get some flak jackets and stuff like that, which our people needed. And I was taking passage in a motor torpedo boat. And I remember the CO of it saying to me, "You'll be handy. You're an ordnance mechanic." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, if anything happens, you'll take care of it." I said, "Yes." And we were on the flank screen of an American convoy going in, approaching the beaches again. This is night time. And the Germans were still trying to stop us, coming out with what they had left of their naval force and other equipment, mines and whatnot they were trying to drop amongst you. And somebody fired some star shell, which unfortunately lit us up. And our ship, our motor torpedo boat, came under heavy fire. That was MTB 705, D-class, 59th MTB flotilla. Originally out of Dover, operating from New Haven as offensive covering force. Very heavily armed, those craft, but also vulnerable. We came under what appeared to be 88mm fire. I don't know whether you've ever heard about the accuracy of the 88mm gun. But the shell which I copped, if you like, caught three of us. And I was at that time clearing a gun stoppage on the .5 machine guns. I had a paratroop helmet, which does not have a brim. A brim helmet is a menace when you were trying to work round a gun. It gets in the way. I thought myself, things are pretty much a lot of ammunition coming across. We'll get these guns back into action. I climbed into this. It was an open-top aircraft-type turret with two Vickers .5 machine guns, water-cooled, mounted in it. Fairly simple to clear, but a round had broken. One of the rounds had broken underneath and had jammed the whole thing. When I managed to clear it, and I turned my head round, I thought, good job somebody's fired some star shell, I can see it now. I pulled the round out, threw it over the side, cleared it with the mallet, got it into firing position, and as I went straightened round to get out, I just looked underneath it and this shell burst about 12, 15 feet above me. And I got it. I got hit in the face and the head. It doesn't show now, thanks to the skill of the surgeons. Most of the damage was internally, went into the head, up into the nasal cavities, pinned my tongue, smashed both of the teeth, broke my jaw. But you become oblivious to that. Somebody bunged me a shell dressing, which I slapped on my face, and somebody else jabbed me with morphia, which we all carried, I hasten to add. And then it was a sort of wild switchback ride for the rest of the night. Somewhere during the night, we were transferred to a frigate, went alongside her for immediate medical attention. The boat herself was hit and on fire, but they put that out and carried on. The only thing I remember with any real clearness is that above the mounting which I had been working on was another machine gun, a twin flexible mounting. Vickers aircraft type machine guns, 303s. And there was a very foul-mouthed Scotsman manning it. And every time he got a stoppage, he used expletives and swear words that I'd never heard in my life before. And I don't think he used the same one twice. And all it, but he provided excellent carrying. He was standing up, excellent covering fire. And yet the fire was intense because we were illuminated, being on fire ourselves. As I say, I was transferred to the frigate. Subsequently, she steamed to New Haven and offloaded us. I was taken ashore on a stretcher, went into an army ambulance, and taken to the Royal Sussex County Hospital in Brighton, which was given over to D-Day casualties. They were expecting a huge influx of casualties, which fortunately didn't occur. They cleaned me up there and they operated on me. I did all the immediate operation, and I was to have specialist examination once I had recovered initially from the wounds at that hospital. During the time I was there, my 19th birthday dawned. The sister, a dear sister, somehow managed to get in contact with my father. I don't know now, to this day. I think they looked through my papers and found a telephone number somewhere. And it was the telephone number of the warden's post. And whoever was on duty went and found my father and got him on the phone. And she explained what had happened and what was going to happen that day. I didn't know it, but he did. I'd been awarded a Distinguished Service Medal during the course of all these other operations. And the medal arrived. What happened was some people arrived around the bed, but before that even, I came to from the operation itself. This must have been earlier. It's a little bit confusing to me now, but the bed was covered in flowers. And as you would, young and impressionable, I thought, oh, this is what it's like. I've gone. But there was a padre there, and he did the classic. He simply said, no, my boy, you haven't passed over. You're required for further duty, or something like that, he said to me. And sister came in, and they straightened me up, and they did all sorts of things with me, clean pyjama top. I'm swathed in bandages. I couldn't say a thing. I could only see out of one eye. There was quite a lot of surface damage, you know. I know it doesn't look like it now. There's only a tiny scar. The big scar is up on the inside. They rolled it all back to do the job. Anyway, there was people turned up from the MTBs, 705, and he was then Lieutenant Lewis, RNVR. He was alongside the bed. And in came an obvious equerry with braid on, followed by a huge man called Admiral Little. Of all things, he must have been about 6 foot something in his stocking feet. And he pinned the DSM on my pyjamas. I took it away again afterwards because it was to be sent home to my father. But it was a terrific day. I was 19. I couldn't really enjoy anything, no cake or anything else. But they sounded the bosun's calls, as the Navy does, when he came into the ward. I had the press and all that sort of thing, but I don't honestly remember too much more beyond that, except for the sister finding me in the toilet for the first time. They wouldn't let you see yourself, and I managed to get this big dressing back off my face. What they'd done, they'd left it open. I could actually see inside my own mouth from the other side. The reason for that was they wanted to be able to heal it properly. And then I was to go up to a rest hospital, which eventually they did. I was in Brighton for, I don't know, several weeks until they cleared me up. Not much more than about a fortnight, I should think. They took us out in the town, and really for sailors, they dressed us in bright blue, which was apparently left over from the First World War. I mean, these were bright blue suits. They could identify anybody if should you come to harm in the town. People there treated us wonderfully. Then they put us into motor coaches and we were taken up to several hospitals. I went into one called the Joyce Green Hospital at Dartford. The reason for that was it was handy, because I was to go for examination to the Royal Victoria Hospital at East Grinstead. And you see the great man himself. He didn't actually do the work. That was Archibald McKindo. And they told us what they were going to do. Well, they told me what they were going to do. They needed to get some comparable flesh and skin and also do a bone graft. I would lose virtually all of my teeth. There was nothing they could do. They'd have to take them all away. A small price to pay, I suppose. And I went backwards and forwards whenever it was ready, and they'd do various grafts and more work at me at the Royal Victoria. It's a wonderful hospital. And they took us all round the hospital. They showed us the pilots and people who were badly burned and shot up to show us what could be done. And they showed us people who were coming back for day treatment, you know. I felt very humble. And also, while I was in Joyce Green, I met soldiers too, dating from the time of Dunkirk, one of whom had been badly wounded in the North African fighting when the Germans were trying to break through to escape. He was an infantryman, and he'd been hit, blown up, and his leg was shattered. But the German tanks were breaking through. And it's said now that nobody understood how he did it, but he ran about a quarter of a mile with a shattered leg, using his rifle to get him along, I think, until he could get somewhere where he was safer. Now, at that time, the Germans had started using what became known as doodle bugs, V1 bombs. And from hospital, Joyce Green Hospital, you could see right across into Barking and Dagenham, and we could see where these buzz bombs were landing, the doodle bugs or whatever, V1s. Originally, just below Joyce Green Hospital, there'd been a light anti-aircraft battery to stop the mine-laying aircraft flying up the Thames estuary. They replaced that with a barrage balloon. The wards at Joyce Green were largely two-storey. They weren't using the upper storeys because of obvious reasons, but the ground did not permit air raid shelters. It was quite waterlogged at tide levels. And this ward was fairly close down to the river. One Sunday, and I was due to receive visitors this day, there again in Joyce Green, we were dressed in royal blue, because it was an army hospital, not a naval one, royal blue, white shirts and red ties, would you believe? You could wear your own headdress, but nothing else. And they had us sitting at this long table in the ward, and the nurses were getting us ready for lunch. And I don't know how to say this, but the chief petty officer, who had been gun-deafened, was totally deaf. He was there because he'd developed a cancer on the lip. He's sitting at the head of the table. We're all sat there. A buzz bomb arrives and it collides with the balloon cable. It goes round and round the balloon cable, and as it reached nearer to the ground, because it had an air fuse, it detonated. It demolished the ward. We'd all gone under the table by this time.